So we've been discussing until now how Achav desired to buy the vineyard of Navos. And Navos, not only does he refuse to sell it to Achav, but he embarrasses him. Right? He rebukes him and tells him off, because Navos knew that when Achav would buy this vineyard, he was going to use it for idol worship. And so, Navos was obviously against idol worship. So he tells Achav, how could I sell the land that belonged to my forefathers, just give it away just like that? Right? He's there by alluding to the fact that Achav is also leaving the land of his forefathers by abandoning Torah and worshiping idols. So Navos saying, how could I leave the land of my forefathers? He's referring to the fact that Achav did the same. So it says that Achav was very upset, but he was upset way more over the words of embarrassment that Navos told him. And he wasn't really upset about the fact that he couldn't buy the vineyard, because there are plenty of other vineyards for sale. It was especially about the fact that he embarrassed his God, so to speak. He told him off. And when he tells Izebel what had happened, he tells he was embarrassed to say that he was really upset about the fact that he's worshipping idols, because he didn't want to show Izebel that words like that can actually get to him. So what he tells Izebel is something else. He tells her, I'm upset about the fact that Navos doesn't want to sell me the vineyard, thereby covering up what he's really upset about, which is the words of Navos against worshipping idols. So that's what we've been discussing so far. Any questions about that? Or can we continue?
I just have one question. Yes. How do we know that he was afraid that they worship idols?
Because that was the custom of the king. Well, the custom of Achav was when he built himself a garden, he would put idols over there.
Oh, okay.
That was his custom. So he knew that obviously he's going to buy a garden, he was going to be placing idols in there as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Apparently that was the custom. So, yeah, we got it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Good. All right, so let's continue with Pasuk Ches. So Izebel decides to take matters into her own hands. She tells Achav, don't you worry, my dear husband, I will take care of everything. Consider it handled. Pasuk Ches, v'tichtav esfarim b'shem Achav, v'tachtavim b'choy samay, v'tishtach esfarim al-zkenim al-charim asher b'irei yoshvim es Navos. So she writes a report of what had happened, the exchange between Avos and Achav, how Navos embarrassed the king, and embarrassed the king's god, the idols. And she sends it to who? She sends it to the skenim, the elders, and she sends it to the chayrim, which are the regular judges. Who does she send it to? She sends it to the elders and the judges who are living in the city of Navos. Why? Because it's customary for a defendant to be judged in his own city. So now we find that she sends it to two different groups of people. She's sending it to the elders, and she's also sending it to the regular judges. The reason for that is because there's two separate judgments over here. One judgment is for Navos embarrassing Achav, and that is dealt by the regular judges. And then we have another judgment, which is for Navos embarrassing the god of the king, which is the idols. And that is handled by the elders. So that's why she's sending two separate reports, one to the elders and one to the regular judges. Now the thing is that the king, right, there were no witnesses present during this conversation. So the problem is that the king is not allowed to go ahead and give testimony over something that had happened to him personally. Right? We find in the Gemara says, Ein adam meisim atmei rasha. A person is not allowed to go ahead and give testimony about himself that he had done something wrong. Right? He's an admission of guilt. If a person walks into a Jewish court and and admits to himself being guilty, his testimony is not accepted. It's just discarded. We don't accept it at all. The Gemara, in fact, goes on even further and says something very fascinating, that if a person that can actually give testimony, that if he had done something wrong together with somebody else, right? He committed a crime together with somebody else. Then what we do is we split his words in half. That's what the Gemara says, which means that you're allowed to accept his testimony about the other person, because somebody else, but you do not accept his testimony about himself. So even though he's telling the same words, right, the same story, right, me and this guy, me and Joe went over and we robbed the bank, whatever it was, right? So he's telling the whole story about himself and about his buddy. We only accept his testimony regarding his buddy, but we reject his testimony about himself. Which is a very interesting concept in Talmud. Well, the Gemara goes on to discuss how it works exactly.
But did they give you a reason for that?
Because ein odom meisim atmei rasha. A person cannot admit that he's guilty. We won't accept it. He's considered to be biased.
So according to the, I hope, the guy says, I did it, you don't believe him.
Nope. You don't believe him.
He can get away with everything.
Yeah. In fact, it's extremely difficult.
If he's caught red-handed.
That's something else. If he's caught
red-handed.
By who? By whom?
By nobody. Empty room. Nobody else there.
Yeah.
He's standing there with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's lying dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they say, did you kill him? Oh, yeah. We don't believe him. That's what you're saying.
Yes. I'll tell you even further. The Talmud describes the following scenario. We got two witnesses, right? Two witnesses, two good kosher witnesses. They see a horrific scene unfolding in front of their eyes. They see a murderer, a potential murderer, with a knife in his hand, a murderous look in his eye. He's chasing after somebody else. Right? The guy is running for his life, literally. Running for his life. Right? And then, so these two witnesses run after him. Yeah? And they warn him. They say, don't do it. If you do it, we're going to prosecute in court. Right? He says, I don't care. I'm doing it anyway. And what happens is, the chasee and the chaser turn a corner.
They don't see nothing.
They don't see anything.
Huh.
The witnesses run after them. Right? 10 seconds later, they turn the corner again,
and
they see the guy lying on the floor in a pool of blood, the murderer standing on top of him with a bloody knife in his hand.
That's what I just said. I don't believe
right, the Gemara says, no. Sorry, Charlie, no testimony. No good. Not accepted. They have to see the action happening in front of their eyes. Circumstantial evidence, as strong as it might be, is not accepted in a Jewish court. At all. Right, today we have CSI, we have all these, you know, DNA tests and ways of proving. In a Jewish court, it will not fly. It will not be accepted.
So anytime, anybody who's done this there, and there's nobody else around to give witness that he did it, you don't believe him, and the guy goes free.
Right. Yeah, I'm saying the Talmud goes on to say that a Jewish court that kills once every 70 years is considered to be a killer court. Because it almost never happens. It's almost impossible for it to happen. You have to have two witnesses to see it in their own eyes. Not only that, but they have to warn them ahead of time. They have to tell them, don't do it. If you do it, we're going to prosecute you in a Jewish court. And the defendant has to accept the warning with the following words. He's got to say, I understand what you're saying, and I'm doing it even so. Right? If he says any other words, if he says, I don't care, or be quiet, stop talking, right? He didn't accept the warning. He has to accept the warning with acknowledging the fact that he understands the warning, he accepts it, and he's doing it even so. And then he has to go ahead and commit the action within 5 seconds. 5 to 10 seconds. If he waits longer than that, we assume he might have forgotten the warning. We had 30 seconds, he waits 1 minute, 60 seconds, too late. He might have forgotten the warning. So it's extremely, it's almost, the defendant has to be almost suicidal to go ahead and be convicted in a Jewish court of law and have the death penalty being carried out.
One question. The self-incrimination, is that only for the death penalty or is that for anything else?
That's only for the death penalty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the other things were more, a bit more lenient. Yeah. And monetary issues is altogether different. The Talmud talks about it in length, how that works. Over there, you might need, you know, only one witness or not at all. Whatever, it's a very complicated topic. But for the death penalty, it's almost impossible for it to happen, right? And there's a lot. It's not really our topic today, but there's a lot of conversation as to what's the point of having it. It's an obvious question. What's the point of having a death penalty in place if it's never ever exercised? Right, so it's all a topic in and of itself. We're not going to really get into it right now because it's not really our topic. Maybe next time. Like we'll give a different separate class about that.
This many pages.
Mm-hmm.
On the topic, you get this as many pages.
Oh yeah. Yes.
All
right. Okay. In any case. Yeah, so again, the king, Ahav, is not allowed to be a witness. He can't give testimony about something that happened to him because he's biased. So therefore, what Ezebel is doing is kind of like some kind of a loop, not really a loophole, but kind of like a way out to give testimony in front of the elders as to what happened without Ahav going ahead and speaking himself and saying, oh, I had this conversation with Nabal, and he embarrassed me and he embarrassed my God. So instead of that, what Ezebel is doing is she's writing a report, sending it to the elders, sending it to the judges, right? This is what happened. Right, and obviously, so if Ahav is telling this story, it must be true, right? Because the king wouldn't lie; he wouldn't just make up a story. So therefore, what Ezebel is doing over here, she's trying to find some kind of a way around Ahav giving testimony, because again, Ahav can't give testimony. Right, because it won't be accepted. So she's saying, listen, you know, we can't really have Ahav give testimony because, you know, it would be embarrassing, humiliating to the king. It would be below him to give testimony to about what happened to him, to himself. Therefore, we got to come up with some kind of other way. So what does she say? Pasuk Tes, V'tichlev v'svarim leimar, kiru tzayim v'yishivus navayis bereshah. Right, call for a fast day and gather all the people and put Navois at the head, at the helm. V'yashivu shnayim anoshim b'nei Belial negdai. And go ahead and give this report that I'm sending you, give it to two witnesses to read. V'yidu leimar berachta elikim v'melech v'yitziu v'siklu. So these witnesses will give testimony. They'll read it. They'll read this letter from the king, this report from the king. And obviously, if they read it, right, it must be true. So they're not really lying, right? They're not lying per se. They're just kind of like a third party. Now, the problem with this really is she's basically like, she's making up the rules as she's going along, right? That's what's happening over here. Because typically, the process of a Jewish court accepting testimony has to be 100% integral. It's got to be honest the whole way through. The Talmud, the Gemara goes on and explains how a testimony is given. The Gemara says something very interesting. That when judges sit in a court, we're talking about a Sanhedrin, right, the high court of 71, which sat in the Beis HaMikdash, That was the only high court that existed in the land of Israel. The way the system worked was there were smaller courts of three. They dealt with more mundane matters like monetary issues. And then every city had a court of 23. Court of 23, you have to have a minimum of 23 judges to deal with capital punishment. Capital punishment was dealt by a court of 23. Every city had a court of 23. The Gemara goes on to explain how they got to that number, but that's not really our topic. And if the court of 23 was not able to determine what the verdict was, then they would move it up to the high court of 71 that was sitting in the Beis Hamikdash. So the Gemara goes on to say that every single judge that sits on a court dealing with a capital punishment, he has to be fluent in all 70 languages. He has to know all languages. Reason being, because what happens...
No interpreters.
Exactly. What happens if you have witnesses from China, right? You want to come give a testimony, right? And they only speak Chinese, right? And the judges only speak Yiddish, right? What are you going to do? Right? Chinese, Yiddish doesn't really go. Right? So therefore, the judges have to speak every single language so they can accept a testimony in Chinese, because they are not allowed to accept a testimony through a third party. You cannot use any interpreters at all, because we're afraid, we're concerned that some of the subtleties of the testimony might get lost in translation. Therefore, the judges have to know every single language so they can accept the testimony directly from
the
witness himself, and not through an interpreter. So we see how direct the testimony that's given has to happen, right? As we pointed out, the witnesses have to be able to see it in their own eyes. They just are giving testimony over circumstantial evidence. It's not good enough. You have to see the action take place in front of them, right? The testimony has to be given to the judge directly, not through any interpreter. And so we see the Talmud goes on and explains how the system works. So what Izevel is doing over here is bending the rules completely, right? She's abusively bending the rules, because she's determined to convict Navais. Now, one more point about this pasuk. Before we go further, the Gemara actually learns out another very interesting concept from this story over here. The Gemara goes on, the Gemara explains how you influence the witnesses to tell the truth, right? The Gemara goes on to say how you tell them, oh, you have to make sure to tell the truth. If you don't tell the truth, then, you know, you're gonna be punished, so on and so forth. The Gemara goes on to say that one of the things you tell the witnesses is that, keep in mind, witnesses, that if someone hired you to lie and to influence the judgment, right? Now, what would you think, right? How would you tell someone, right, if they were in fact hired to lie, right? They had $100,000 wired into their Swiss bank account, offshore bank account, right? Nobody knows about it, right? They've got $100,000, each one of them. How would you go ahead and psychologically influence them to tell the truth? And say, you know what? We're lying. We're not saying the truth. What would you say? What would you tell them? What do you think?
They're all going to be... Everyone involved is going to be guilty.
Okay.
Whenever we convict the guy off.
So you can say anything, scare them, right? Yeah. If you're lying, you're going to be punished. Okay. It's a very direct way.
You could appeal to their sense of justice and
morality,
or you can also, if they have any sort of faith in God, you could say he's going to know whether you're lying or not.
Right. Yeah, that's true. You can say that. The problem is that $100,000 is kind of, you know, is also very convincing, you know?
Nowadays, $100,000 is nothing.
Right. Back then, it was much more.
Say $100 million. Nowadays, right. The ball player is making millions of dollars. What's $100,000? It's ridiculous.
That is true.
Get it up there.
All right. Half a million. Right. A million.
Yeah.
A million.
A lousy ball player makes $1 million.
Right.
Can't even hit. It's ridiculous these days.
I know. Terrible.
So what would you say? You tell them.
So what do you say?
If you're lying, that's going to happen to you. What were you trying to do to somebody else?
No. What you're referring to is something else. The Gemara. What you're referring to is what's called edim zoemim.
Yeah.
If the witnesses are proven to be lying, but in a very specific way, right? There's two ways the witnesses can be proven to be wrong, to be lying, right? If they give testimony that. So-and-so, I don't know, murdered someone, yeah? And then you have another set of witnesses.
You couldn't decide.
And they say, you can't, this can't be true. Why? Because the defendant was with us in Bermuda, right, on that date. So that's one option. In that case, what happens is nothing, right? It's just a mistrial. The witnesses are not convicted. The defendant is not convicted because we have two conflicting testimonies about the same person, right? One set of witnesses says that he was in Malden in this and this date and murdered someone, right? The other set of witnesses say no, he was in Bermuda with us and he obviously couldn't have committed this murder. However, if the two witnesses that are giving the testimony, right, after they give the testimony, two other witnesses come along and say that you, the witnesses, were with us on such and such date in Bermuda, right? So you obviously can't give testimony because you weren't even there, right? In that case, it turns out that's a direct conflict, a direct contradiction. In that case, what happens is what you're saying. Yeah. Is that whatever the witnesses wanted to cast on the defendant is now going to be done to them. So if they were giving testimony and they were trying to convict him of murder, which gets the death penalty, then once they're proven wrong, lying in a way where they were in a different place, in that way, they will get the death penalty instead. There are a few cases that the Talmud talks about that they don't get what they were planning to do. But, in any case, the Gemara actually says, back to what we were discussing before, one of the ways of influencing the witnesses to say the truth is by telling them that, you know what, right? If someone hired you to say a lie, right? If someone hired you to say a lie, the person who hired you looks down at you. They look down at you. They consider you some lowlife. How do we learn that from? We learn it from this pasuk. Because what does Yizeva call these witnesses? Right? In pasuk Yod, Vashivu Shnai Manashim B'nei Vlial. Right, Kevin, what does it say in English? How does the English translate it?
Scrandos.
What?
Scrandos. I don't like to say it very quickly.
Scoundrels, right? So she herself, she hired these false witnesses. She's calling them. How do you say it again?
Scoundrels.
Right.
This is
unscrupulous people. It depends on
unscrupulous.
Right. Crooked. Exactly. She's calling them crooked people. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So we see from here, it's a very interesting psychological aspect, is that the way to influence the witnesses to say the truth is to say that the person who hired you considers you a crooked person. Right? That's how you influence them to say the truth. Which is very interesting. Okay, let's continue for a few more minutes. So this is the plan of Yizeva. This is how she's planning to convict Navais, right, it's basically she's making up the rules, right? She's setting up a trial that, you know, doesn't really is not really according to the rules of any court, of any Jewish court for sure. But she's setting it up in a way where Navais for sure will be convicted. So let's continue. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayasu anshe ira yaskeni v'chayim m'sher yishim v'irai. Kasher sholcha aleihem izavel. Kasher kasa b'svarim m'sher sholcha aleihem. So obviously, Izavel was a very powerful woman, and the judges and the elders are a little bit scared of her, right? And so they do exactly as she says, even though she's really bending the rules, and she's not doing it the way it's supposed to be done. So they set up this whole court case, and they bring these witnesses, and they call everybody, because again, the way of judging, any time a king was judged, right, you don't judge him in a way where anybody else is being judged. He's got to be judged in front of everybody, right? It's this big thing. Everybody comes along, they watch it. It's kind of like a show. And that was, again, because the king is obviously big news, so that's why. Again, also for the honor of the king, that's why it's typical for the whole, all the people to come along and watch the trial as it's happening. So, for the Pasukim Beis, Karutzayim v'Shivu is Navais Bereshah. So they called out a fast day, right? Everybody's going to come. Now we're going to judge something that happened, this terrible thing that occurred to the king, that Navais committed against the king himself. Pasukim Gimel, v'Yavoh Shnei Anashim B'nei V'Liyah, v'Yeshvu Negdoi v'Yehidu, Anshalei Abliyal, es Navais Negedo Am Leimor, Beirach Navais Elokim V'Melech, V'yirtziyu Michutz Ha'ir, V'yizkalu V'Avanim V'Yamais. Right? So they, in fact, carry out this terrible plan of Izebel. They say, oh, this terrible man, Navais, he insulted the king, he insulted his God, and they accept this, the testimony of these two lying witnesses. And they carry out the decree. They carry out the decree, right, to embarrass the king, to influence the king. Right, it's a terrible thing. And they go ahead and they carry out the decree. They stone him. Yeah, they carry out the decree and they stone him. So
she set up the trial with a lie. The whole thing was a lie.
Oh yeah, the whole thing was a lie.
Does it mean Hashem, or is it just the Baal?
It means the Baal. He was insulting the Baal. He wasn't insulting Hashem.
Right.
Yeah, it's referring to his God, meaning not Hashem. Yeah. To the king and his God, which is the Baal. His Kong is God is God is idols. Right. It's not really Hashem.
But the Hebrew says Elohim.
Right. And many times it refers to when it but it could, when it says Elohim, it could refer to idols as well, right? So, for example, let me just illustrate it. For example, any time you read a pasuk, right, we say when it says the word of Hashem, then you can't read the word of, you can't say the name of Hashem, so you would say Elohim, right? However, if it's referring to an idol, then you could actually say, right, like Habal Elohim, right? Elohei Habal, right? So that's, over there, you could say the name, the full name, because it's not really the name of Hashem. It's the God of the Baal, right? So something else. Over there, you could say the name the way it is, and you don't have to say Elohim. Because Elohim is only referring to Hashem. Over there, you can't say the full name.
Okay, so if I was reading that, I would say Elohim. Because it was not Hashem.
Right, correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Berach Navais Elohim v'melech. Yeah.
Because they have, in the translation, they have God with a capital G.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't vouch for the translation. Yeah. I don't know, but...
That's interesting. Wasn't that... That's why I had heard this talk on tape, and I'm learning Malachim Bet right now, but I was talking to my teacher, and I didn't know about the thing with the idols that he dotted in the he would put that in the garden. So I appreciate
Sure.
Yeah. Isn't that it? That she wasn't Jewish, Zevil?
She wasn't Jewish? I haven't heard that. Where'd you see that?
I heard she wasn't Jewish.
Yeah, there are different...
Didn't when somebody heard that she was married to the king there, but she wasn't Jewish?
Yeah, there are some commentators that say that. I haven't seen any commentators here say that, but there are some commentators who say that. Well, that I've heard that.
I thought I heard that someplace.
Yeah. Could be. Okay. Well, we have to finish now. But just before you finish, I just wanted to refer to a very interesting anecdote, since we're talking about kings being embarrassed. We find that when King David, right, a while back, probably a few years back by now, we learned about the episode with King David and Bathsheba, and how King David went ahead and he was intimate with Bathsheba, which wasn't technically a sin, but he was held accountable for it. And what happened was is that the people knew about it. Everyone knew about what had happened with Bathsheba, and they. So the Gemara says something very interesting. The Gemara says that when King David went ahead and gave a class or a talk, whatever it is, to the Jewish people, you would have a similar thing that happened to Achav, right? Someone would get up and raise his hand and say, "King David, I have a question. Now, I was wondering, what is the verdict for someone who is intimate with a married woman, right? Clearly trying to embarrass the king, right? So listen to King David's response. You know how he responds? He says, someone who's intimate with a married woman, misasa b'chenek, he gets a death penalty. However, yesh l'chelek l'olam haba, he has a portion in the world to come. On the other hand, someone who embarrasses someone in public does not have a portion in the world to come.
He gave him an answer.
Yeah. That's the answer that King David gave.
Put him in his place.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just an interesting anecdote. Okay, well, we'll continue from here next week.
Thank you very much.